We are back. Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I am still exhausted, headed swimming from that unbelievable Oklahoma City Golden State series. And I am going to have John Hamm on right after we talk to Danny about previewing Cavs Warriors. And John and I are going to talk about Oklahoma City's offseason, Kevin Durant's options, what it looks like for them this year, 2017, the extensions for Deion Waiters, Steven Adams, fascinating stuff with him. But first, Danny, what's going to happen in this series?
It has to be noted that Cleveland has had a fantastic run through the Eastern Conference, but I would argue that they've faced pretty favorable matchups. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. None of those teams has had anyone that you look at as being a good option to guard LeBron James. It's been Bazemore. Damari Carroll isn't really big enough. Patrick Patterson is a power forward. You know, there's no Andre Iguodala. And the Warriors probably have three guys who could do a better job on LeBron than any of the guys, or at least two. Draymond, who probably won't be guarding him much. Andre, even Barnes is probably a better option than just due to his strength than a lot of these guys. Clay at least could switch onto him okay. And even Azealia as a guy you could switch and pick a role. He's not as good as Biyombo, but maybe someone who could help. So that's number one. I also think that Klay Thompson is probably a better defender of Kyrie Irving than anyone that they've had. But to me, the biggest reason why I think this series may not be as close as some people are looking at is just that the Cavs are not going to stop the Warriors at all.
They have some major defensive liabilities in this series, and Amon Shumpert last year did a really nice job on Klay Thompson, but he has been largely marginalized in the rotation for legitimate reasons.
Yeah, he was playing 40 minutes a game, and so was Delly in those finals. You know, that's like, I mean, you look at their lineup to start, it was Thompson, pretty darn good defender, better at the four probably than the five because he is pretty decent at switching and can move his feet, but not a great rim protector. Mozgov was excellent defensively in that series at the five. And then Delly does a pretty nice job at point guard. He's good at getting through screens. And Amon Shumpert was excellent as well. And then LeBron, obviously was probably, LeBron is probably a little better defensively this year because he doesn't have as much of an offensive load. But you had four very good defenders in their starting lineup. And now you have four pretty bad defenders in their starting lineup.
Yeah, and
actually, that's being too harsh on J.R. Smith, but a downgrade certainly from where they were last year.
And the other challenge with that, you talk about average, below average, and all that, is playing guys who are liabilities. And Cleveland is going to spend a lot more time with defensive liabilities on the floor than Oklahoma City did. So I think they'll have weaker strengths and much stronger weaknesses.
So that said, this Cavs offense is really good, and they can get super hot from three-point range, just like the Warriors can, and maybe even hotter at times. I don't think that they have anyone quite as good as Stephen Clay. Nobody does. But what Channing Frye has been able to do, Love can get on fire. J.R. Smith can get just about as hot as anyone. Kyrie Irving is one of the best point guards in the league at shooting threes. And then they've got LeBron, who can back down, get the shooting around him, drive to the basket, force help, and then find those guys. You know, there's a reason that they were setting three-point records against what were not bad defenses. And Atlanta, a pretty good defense, although part of that was helped by their scheme of trapping the pick and roll. So Cleveland has a lot more upward variability in their offense. I think that they are going to win two games in this series just because that's the way three-point variance works, that they are just going to be hotter than the Warriors on some nights. But in general, they are just going to really struggle to stop the Warriors, who are even a better offensive team even than this Cavs team is. Steph Curry, I think we can conclude, is back now after how he played in Game 7. And this is just going to be a much worse matchup for the Cavs than Oklahoma City would have been.
And on the line of matchups, one of the most important things to watch in this series is going to be how Steve Kerr uses his personnel. Because if he wants to go ruthless and play the death lineup or things like that, let's say 35 to 40 minutes, the Cavs don't have an answer for that. You know, that's that. Then you get into the combinations where Channing Frye doesn't really have a place to be defensively, and he doesn't have a place to be offensively as much because the Warriors just have the personnel to be on him. And if you want to just sit Harrison Barnes on him or somebody like that, he'll do a decent enough job. If he wants to play Bogut and Azili and Spates and Varejao, whoever else, more, then that starts to open the door a little bit, especially because Cleveland has been phenomenal at the beginning of the second quarter, which became this giant bugaboo for most of the last series for the Warriors.
Before we continue talking about this matchup, I want to talk to you about Athletes Collective. I've actually gotten to know the founder a little bit. He's a young guy just starting off in Toronto, and he had an idea basically for great quality activewear that doesn't have a logo on it and therefore costs 30 to 40% less. He sent me some of the stuff. I've loved it. It's very simple. No logo, long sleeve t-shirt, cut-off sleeve t-shirt, shorts. That's about it for guys who want to get some cheap workout gear that's really high quality. I've been working out in it regularly. It wicks sweat away extremely well. My girlfriend says it looks good. And it's also pre-shrunk. So unlike a lot of kind of moisture wicking stuff, you could just throw it in the washer, throw it in the dryer. If you're a guy doing your own laundry, it's not going to shrink on you. So that's another thing that's awesome about Athletes Collective. So give it a chance if you're someone who cares more about quality when in your workout gear than you do about logos. Go to athletescollective.com, enter the promo code CAPSPACE, all one word. Remember that. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time in the program. That's also how they know that you came from us. And your benefit will be 15% off your first order. All orders include free shipping and returns to the U.S. or Canada. 100% satisfaction guaranteed. athletescollective.com, offer code CAPSPACE. That's going to be the key time to me. And I could even see the Warriors losing a game early because that Cleveland lineup to start the fourth quarter for a conventional team and to start the second quarter for a conventional team is unstoppable. They, with Fry at center, I mean, and they're just run the same play over and over again. And Toronto couldn't stop them, right? Like they've got LeBron who is playing the four. Delly, a decent shooter. You know, he's probably the biggest weak link. Richard Jefferson and Shumpert are guys who can at least, you know, shoot the ball well enough from 3-point range that you don't want to just put your center on them or something. And then Fry, obviously, is probably the best shooter of any of those guys. He's on the backside as you're running the Delly LeBron pick and rolls. Now, part of how Golden State could maybe deal with that is to just switch those plays. But then LeBron, you know, if they do it early enough in the clock, LeBron could back down on someone like Livingston, someone like Thompson, and force help. And then, you know, the shooting will be an issue as well. Although with Jefferson and Shumpert, it's not as much of a worry there if you're trying to help out in a post-ice situation. But Kerr usually plays Maurice Spates to start that time. Or maybe he'll go with Azili. And I really think he should consider rejiggering the rotation to put Draymond Green back on the floor at center during those minutes to just take that away. Because otherwise, I could really see that Golden State is going to get smashed in those minutes. I think that when the starters are on the floor, they will have a massive advantage going after Kyrie and Love and pick and roll, for example. But, and I think Draymond Green is going to, we're going to remember that he's like a really awesome offensive player because OKC took him totally out of what he was trying to do, making him go one-on-one. But I think the Warriors could just get completely slaughtered in those minutes and they might lose a game early before they adjust.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a very real possibility, especially when Kerr got more, I guess you could say, more emboldened after his Kumbaya strategy worked incredibly well in Game 7. You know, the idea of doing that, and particularly in a home game. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the Warriors lose one of the first two at home because they go to that lineup and they just get massacred. But on the other side, something that I noticed when I was doing other work when we were talking about the crunch time stuff for Game 6 is the Warriors have been this historically great clutch situation team, you know, 5 points or less in less than 5 minutes. The Cavs have been positive, but lightly positive. And that makes sense when you think about both teams' personnel and where they're going to go. And those differences will be exacerbated when they face each other.
Yeah, for me, I always felt like the Cavs' best option against the Warriors was to just go with their offensive lineups, play Love at center, get enough shooting on the floor. And then once you, because those ISO post-ups from LeBron, I mean, Andre did a great job on those. But if LeBron just keeps backing down and keeps backing down, like Andre is not going to be able to keep him out forever. But, you know, they're playing with Thompson. They were playing with Mozgov last year. So you could bring help on those plays. But if they just play Love at center, now I don't know that the Warriors will be able to stop LeBron. They're either going to have to double and give up an open three, or LeBron can just keep backing down. I thought that although they missed, there were a couple of possessions down the end of that Christmas Day game where they went to that lineup with Love at center, and it actually looked pretty ugly for the Warriors. You're like, oh, they might actually have some trouble stopping this. And then maybe at that point, you might go to Draymond Green on LeBron instead. And they're going to be switching everything. They're going to be pressuring. Kyrie could try to go one-on-one too. I mean, the Warriors will definitely be switching a lot. And I think Draymond might be one of the few guys in the league who could actually keep LeBron from just getting into his spot on an ISO post-up. And LeBron, I think, is, you know, Cleveland's going to really struggle when he's out of the game. But I think they do have a chance to keep up offensively pretty close against the death lineup if they just decide, all right, we're going to go all offense, and, you know, if they score on us, they score.
Yeah, and you're right that taking away the help options is a really important facet of that, because if Shumpert's on the floor, if Thompson's on the floor, it gives the Warriors an out. And LeBron is an incredible passer, but if there are options that he just can't utilize to his maximum effect, that's just something he can't do.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I mean, I wonder how much we're going to see Shumpert in this series. J.R. Smith had a horrible finals last year, probably below what you would have expected from him. He's been on fire all playoffs. His defense has been better. Klay Thompson, you got to remember, did nothing last year, I think in part because he was just coming off of that concussion, was out of rhythm as a result of that. And also just the Cavs' strategy was, Iman Shumpert, you're just going to be glued to this guy in the corner. And that's why they had those 4-on-3s, really more like 3-on-2s all the time once they went with Green at center. I do think that Bogut is likely to not be particularly effective in this series. He's basically on the play okay one out of every three games plan at this point in his career. Maybe he'll have some decent games at home, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a short leash. Another thing that we might see is, does Kerr start Andre Iguodala in the series, even if Bogut starts, so you go to that same lineup that they use in Game 7?
I fully expect Iguodala to start. It just makes sense. It worked well, and he's going to get that assignment. I think it'll happen Game 1. You know, they might dance around it a little bit, but it just makes so much sense for the exact purpose that you're trying to get with Iguodala, which is line him up with LeBron James as much as humanly possible.
Yeah, you remember that in the finals last year, we were calling for this move. Instead, they went to the death lineup, which was a much better move, just getting Bogut out of there. But LeBron James definitely kills Harrison Barnes. I think Barnes has improved a little bit in terms of his isolation defense this year. Klay Thompson also has, but I do not like that matchup for the Warriors of LeBron on Harrison Barnes for the first 6 minutes of every game. It wouldn't surprise me to see Kerr start off conventionally. They did smack this team around, although it was a team that played Mozgov and Varejao for 32 minutes combined, part of that because they're getting blown out in the last game. What are some of the other little questions that are popping up for you here?
Kyrie Irving's pick and roll defense.
And Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving's pick and roll defense. There was a stats that came out, I think it was Haverstraw, had this article on just how badly that two-man unit was getting destroyed in the pick and roll, and certainly down the end of games. I mean, like, the Warriors' offense was unrecognizable. They just had to go one-on-one, and their guys were so good by the end of that Thunder series. Cleveland is not going to be able to execute that strategy of switching everything, I don't think. And if they do, I think they're going to get, you know, Love can't do that against Steph or Clay. Even LeBron, Steph has been able to blow by him at times in these last couple of years. So I don't think they can do that. I think they're just going to have to trap on the pick and roll. And, you know, then it'll be that 4-on-3 and hope for the best. I just don't know what the plan is for Cleveland with their main guys like Fry, another guy who's just going to get murdered trying to play pick and roll defense against the Warriors' main units.
And they also have bad help defense. And so you're not
Yeah, no rim protection at all. That was the other thing that messed up the Warriors so much of the Thunder series that will be completely absent in this series.
Yeah, so I think the Warriors are just going to see basically the seas open up for them in that sense of all the parts that make Oklahoma City amazing and unique and just such a bear for the Warriors are largely off the table. So I think there's a sigh of relief in that sense. And yeah, Cleveland is a much more potent offensive team, and they succeed in a very different way on that end. But the Warriors are going to be able to get in their flow offensively, and I think that will help them overall. And Golden State hasn't shown it very often this year, which is surprising considering how great they are and how their remarkable record. But they still have the same defensive ceiling that they did last season.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Cleveland, they've run some better stuff this year. The offense has been better under Lou. The defense has been a lot worse, too, under Lou. That's something that should be noted. And I do think down the end of games that while they can go to LeBron all the time, they are going to be a little too ISO heavy compared to what the Warriors do. So that's another thing to look out for, that while they've made some strides, I'm still not sure that they are moving the ball quite as much to avoid predictability, especially down the end of games. So that'll be something to look at. What's your strategy defensively if you're Cleveland? I mean, is there anything we talked about that that we haven't talked about as ways they could use to slow down Golden State?
I think they should put Love on Barnes as much as they can, just because the help responsibilities aren't... Love isn't good at help responsibilities, so you do that, and Barnes isn't going to be able to exploit that as much as possible, and they don't use him much as a screener, though that might draw that out of the Warriors, so that's one nuance that they can do. And, like, the challenge for the Cavs, if they're going to play JR a lot, and JR is a very good player, and not Shumpert, is your defensive alignments have to be much more rigid, because he can't bounce between the positions as well as Shump can. So then that means Kyrie is going to have to do a lot more. Like, he's going to have to mentally think, okay, I'm going to have to play that. And his game one, you know, was the best defensive game I've ever seen him play, game one of the finals last year. But he's going to have to do that 6 times for them to have a chance.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think another thing that's going to be interesting is the Warriors will be switching a fair amount. Are they going to try to throw it to Kevin Love? I mean, posting up on Draymond Green, that's not going to work. Barnes maybe might be able to get a little something, but don't forget, what's Kevin Love shooting on? We looked at it a couple of games ago. He's shooting like 30% on twos in the playoffs. I mean, I think his three-point shooting can be deadly, but that's an interesting question of whether Love is even going to be on the floor. I mean, you could even see the Cavs just going ultra small as well. Thompson at center. Maybe they have both Dele and Irving out there, or Shumpert instead of Dele, and just trying to defend the Warriors a little bit better. But I still don't think that team stops the Warriors. I like having Love out there at center down the end. Just try to outscore them offensively. That would be my approach. It's because you're not going to stop them anyway. I mean, Thompson is not really somebody who protects the rim. Like, he's good at switching, but you know, nobody at this point is as a big can stop Steph Curry one-on-one. It looks like if he's playing the way he was playing on Monday, maybe he's not back and consistent, but he sure was for one game and most of game 6 too.
I like that you brought up the Dellavedova-Irving combination, because I actually think that's something that they should close with as well, but use one of the jump shooting bigs instead of Thompson, you know, whether Love or Fry, whoever's playing better. And the benefit there is that you get another ball handler. Dellavedova is also a great open shot shooter. So you lose, you gain some flexibility, just because if something breaks down, I trust him a lot more to do something with that than whoever he's replacing, which is probably Iman Shumpert. And yeah, he's a worse defender and less versatile, but I don't think that difference matters as much as just getting more quality shots and having somebody on the floor who can also, I don't know, be somebody who helps give them an edge, as crazy as that sounds.
Yeah, I expect that Thompson will have a much better series this year than he did last year. I mean, that's another thing Cleveland's going to struggle to deal with. If it's just Klay Thompson coming off a screen from Andrew Bogut or Festus Ezeli or Draymond Green, is Kevin Love going to get out there on him and stop that, you know, the way the Thunder switched everything? Now it's got to be JR getting through those screens. He's done an okay job, but he's not going to stay with Thompson all the time. And so I just with Draymond doing the 4-on-3s, like, he having to go one-on-one against Kevin Durant or whoever else on the Thunder because they're switching everything just made him look so bad. And now he's going to be able to get into the post on switches against guys like Kyrie. He's going to have that 4-on-3. Also, I think that the Warriors could really hurt the Cavs in transition more than the Cavs will hurt the Warriors. And also, one thing the Cavs really used to hurt the Warriors a lot last year was getting on the offensive glass, and they're not at all the same offensive rebounding team. They're only 9th this year. Love doesn't offensive rebound that much anymore. Fry doesn't hardly at all. Thompson is really the only guy in the rotation who's going to be a factor on that end. One thing I want to talk about, though, is LeBron James defensively. I think that he is just going to have to have an unbelievable defensive series. I don't know whether he has that in him any longer, though.
And you're going to have a tough spot with him, just because I think he's in some ways most valuable as a help defender in this series, but there isn't really a place to put him to make that a reliable assignment, and he's one of their few pick-and-roll guys that they actually trust, so he's probably going to be up top. So he's going to kind of have to be two places at once, and you know, he can do that, but it's a big burden to shoulder for an entire series when he's going to be the linchpin of their offense as well.
Any other players you're looking at as smaller bit players off these benches who are going to be important?
Livingston. He had a rough series, against Oklahoma City, but he'll have a lot more places to hide in this series. And even if what he brings is just stability, I think that can be enough. And last year, a little bit in the finals, they danced around with Livingston playing with both Curry and Thompson. And while Iguodala, I think, serves that role better, just to get him a little bit of rest if they can do that in certain spots and just use Livingston as the inferior guy in that. Maybe that's when you give Draymond the LeBron assignment. That could be big. And how Kerr uses bench. But I wanted to go back to something you just said, which is, I think, really important, which is Cleveland's offensive rebounding. And Oklahoma City is so hard in that way, not only because they have a lot of good offensive rebounders, but they have people like Russell Westbrook who just crash the glass. And so you have to account for them in a different way. And sometimes Russ just gets to a ball that nobody else will get to. Cleveland doesn't really have that sort of a thing. So you can do it a little bit more by system and by personnel. Just basically make sure you have a guy on Tristan. And I think that's a lot closer to the kind of defensive rebounding that the Warriors are better at.
Yeah, what was so shocking about the Oklahoma City series was, wow, this is a team that has more athleticism up and down the roster than Golden State does. Not something that we've really seen much of with their length, guys like Robertson, Ibaka. They were getting most of the loose balls throughout the series, whether it was on the offensive glass, steals, getting out in transition, etc. Now the Warriors are going to have that advantage. I mean, LeBron, still an elite athlete, but not someone who's going to be killing it in the effort categories over the course of the game. Thompson, maybe to a certain extent, but he's a good athlete, not an elite athlete. And then Dele will scrap, but he's also just not physically the equal of some of these guys. So in transition, getting the loose balls, double teaming, scrambling, that's where the Warriors are going to get back to what we recall from them. So, all right, I know you got to go. What's the prediction that you have for the series?
Warriors in six. I could see it going either end of that, but I think six is the most likely outcome.
I think so, too. I just think that Cleveland's offense is good enough that, like, that bench unit could win them a game, that they could get really hot. But I think it is more likely to be a Warriors sweep than Warriors in seven. I think that just we're forgetting about how awesome this Warriors team was. The Cavs look great in the Eastern Conference playoffs. Fine, that's the Eastern Conference playoffs. They still can't stop anybody. I see no way that they can stop the Warriors in this series. And when you just look at who's going to be guarding Stephen Curry, Kyrie Irving. Who's going to be guarding LeBron James? Finals MVP, Andre Iguodala. These are two great offensive teams. I would even say that the Cavs are pretty close to the Warriors, but they are not the Warriors. And then defensively, there's just no comparison whatsoever. And so that's why I think, I think that the Warriors are 2-1 to win the series. If indeed Steph is really back consistently, and it seems like he is, and they have home court, I think that is like way too low for the Warriors' chances. I think it's more like 3-1, 4-1 that they win this series, and that we're just forgetting about both the fundamentals of what these teams are on both ends and what these teams did during the regular season. Great Cavs shooting performance at times in these playoffs aside.
And something when I was working on my athletic pieces for today that I realized is that the Warriors just beat a great Thunder team, a team that is a terrible matchup for them, without getting a definitive Draymond Green game. And it is incredibly hard to imagine that against a team that is so much more suitable to his talents that will happen again.
Yeah, and Livingston, he's going to be much better this series. He'll be able to get to his post-ups. He'll be able to do some things in transition. He's scoring mid-range. Like, there's nobody on this Cavs roster that's going to, like, cause big problems for him the way pretty much everyone on the Thunder did. So that's another thing that, I think he could play, especially if they go with Green at center for large portions of the game. He could play 20 to 25 minutes in the series and be very effective like he was in the finals. All right, I've got John Hamm, Oklahoma City Thunder cap expert, waiting in the line. Let's talk first about Vistaprint. They have been instrumental in supporting my small business. That's, of course, what this podcast is. And the way I got started with them was through their special offer, 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. CAPSPACE, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time in the program. Every single one of our sponsors has CAPSPACE involved in either the URL or the offer code. This is the offer code, obviously, at Vistaprint.com. And the beauty of Vistaprint, not only do they offer business cards, but tons of other custom products for home and office needs, whether it's business cards, postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, coffee mugs, whatever you want to put a logo on, put a message on, whether it's for fun or business, they could do it for you. Very easy to use and user-friendly. They have a great interface for when you're designing your business card. It took me about 15 minutes or so. Very easy. And if you don't necessarily have your own ideas, you can use some of their industry-specific templates to help you out as well. So they guarantee that you'll love your products every time, or they will make it right. They have great economies of scale because they're a bit larger than your local print shop, but offer the same level of service. So again, the offer is 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Use that CapSpace code at checkout so they know that you came from us. Get that 50% savings over the regular site pricing. And it's a great way to support the show and get some support for your small business. It's Vistaprint.com, offer code CapSpace. So Oklahoma City's season is over. I think it probably went about as well as could have been hoped in this season where you had these two other dominant teams in the West as far as being able to convince Kevin Durant to stick around. And joining me to talk about their off season is John Hamm, Thunder Insider for 107.7 The Franchise in Oklahoma City, also a contributor to Daily Thunder, and a great cap expert going back to the early, early days with Larry Kuhn in the 99 CBA. We finally had a chance to meet in person when I was out in Oklahoma City, and really glad to have you on, John.
No, thanks so much for having me.
So what is the mood now in Oklahoma City before we get into the numbers geekery that we like? Maybe we could talk about these emotions. Is that the word? That's what people tell me, at least these things exist. Like, how are people feeling now in Oklahoma City after what is a crushing loss, but also a really nice season?
Yeah, you know, this morning I woke up expecting to see the sun, but it was raining. So I don't think the sun has come out yet today, to be honest with you. But last night there were some emotions definitely pouring out. You know, a lot of it was to be expected. A lot of it was just irrational. But really the big debate that I'm hearing online, on air and everything, is whether Oklahoma City choked or not. I have been in the camp that says, no, it's not a choke, because that's not giving enough credit.
That's ridiculous. I think, like, someone asked me that on the radio today, and it's like, all right, they were up 3-1 against one of the greatest teams ever, admittedly maybe not playing at their best, but they took the Warriors completely out of what they wanted to do offensively all series with their switching. It was a great tactic. Their length, their intensity, they improved their defense so much over the course of the regular season. And it wasn't like they fell off. They were still playing at the same level. I felt like it's just that the Warriors were able to up their level even more. And just, it was just great shot making by Klay and Steph in ways that, like, frankly, we've just never seen anything like that in the NBA playoffs before. And I think they have absolutely nothing to hang their heads about personally.
Absolutely. That's how I feel as well. And I just can't put this in the same camp as the Clippers last year versus the Rockets. You know, a Rockets team that had basically given up on their coach at one point in the series, and, you know, the Clippers let squatter that one away. So that's been the big debate we've been going over here on air. I think people are still kind of coming to terms with it. And, of course, you know, the articles that people have had saved as drafts for a while are starting to go online now about, you know, where is Kevin Durant going to go? And that's everyone is just monitoring everything and kind of reacting to it. So it's a little nerve wracking because of the uncertainty of the future, I think.
Yeah, I guess too, I think most people assumed that they were going to lose last night. I thought they played better than probably could have been expected under such adverse circumstances after that gut punch loss in game six. But I think after that happened, I think people may have kind of been expecting it at that point.
I think mostly people were just, if nothing else, the ones that could, you know, have kind of a clear head about the situation. They were happy that the Thunder did not get, you know, blown out of the building. They competed. They were up by six at halftime. The third quarter got away from them, and that turned out to be the ball game, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, this team coming into the playoffs, if you'd have told the fan base, okay, you're going to beat San Antonio and you're going to extend Golden State to seven games, I don't think anyone would have believed you, because just how the team was so up and down during the regular season, unable to show extended signs of consistency on the defensive end, to pull that all together and finish the way they did. Yeah, it would be nice to have the Larry O'Brien trophy in Oklahoma City, but they've got nothing to hang their heads about. This is better than what I think a lot of people expected going in.
Yeah, I think that's right. And for Oklahoma City, I thought that Billy Donovan had a great point too, which the audio we played on yesterday's podcast about game seven was that, like, if you look at the series in the aggregate, it just, you know, the order was that the Thunder were up 3-1. But if the order had just been different and they'd had the same performance, I think people would have thought about things in a much different manner. So let's now, I mean, the point of this is the off-season preview. How are you feeling about this team? Some of maybe the supporting players, I mean, we'll just make the assumption for right now that Kevin Durant returns. What do you think about this team going forward, some of the players, the coaching staff, management? I mean, why don't we start with just what some of those role guys, Enes Kanter, Deion Waiters, and you know the rest of the supporting players were able to do. How do you feel about them going forward now?
The one thing that I've been stressing lately on air is that Oklahoma City had the 10th youngest team in the league. So they've got seven guys on the roster that are 25 and younger. And now that includes Josh Huestis. We don't quite know how he fits into the future plans, but you know, it does include Steven Adams, Enes Kanter, Cameron Payne, Deion Waiters. So there's a lot of youth on the team that still have room to grow. I personally, there was a point of the season, I think after it was around January, February, where I was pretty much done with the Deion Waiters experience. I felt like he's been in Oklahoma City for a year. We're still seeing a lot of the same things that we saw when he came over from Cleveland. But, you know, he turned out to be his defense in the playoffs just astounds me. The way he was able to stonewall guys in the post and the way he was able to chase guys and stick with them. And he made some timely shots as well. His stats don't blow you away necessarily, but you know, I thought Deion was key to their run. Enes Kanter, obviously, against San Antonio.
Let's talk about Deion for a second, too. I agree with you. I think that he, you know, his three-point shooting will kind of wax and wane. He, you know, doesn't get a ton of touches, but I think he could do a little bit more as far as being the guy to initiate the offense while those other guys are on the floor. He clearly is miscast in all bench units as being the main guy, but I think if you wanted to start off with a pick and roll to him and then you swing the ball to the other guys, which they don't do at all, we'll get to that too, but they could be valuable there. He's an okay spot-up shooter. Maybe you'd want someone a little better at that, but I think his defense, and we'll talk about specifically how they match up with the Warriors, because that's the dragon that they're going to have to slay in the Western Conference. And I think a lot of their moves are probably need to just be focused on that now, but he was a great matchup against the Warriors because, as you mentioned, he can switch. He's got that barrel chest. He's really strong. Sean Livingston had zero success posting him up. Even Draymond Green, who is a really strong guy himself, wasn't able to post him up. Like, a lot of what they were able to do, he and Russ, their ability to hold up on switches in the post, it's an enormous part of what they're doing. And I think he, in particular, on the defensive end, is a great matchup against Golden State.
Yeah, absolutely. So, his future is kind of somewhat up in the air, probably hinges on, you know, what Durant does. And, you know, we can get into some of that. But needless to say, I think Deion showed me and a lot of the people here a lot come the postseason. A lot of people, you know, Waiters Island, right? Is the term we all use. I basically stayed off of Waiters Island because I got tired of swimming back and forth. But, I think it's possible. And again, the guy is only 24. Is he turned 25 yet? He might be 24.
I think I got him listed as 24 on my sheet.
Okay. So it looks like maybe, you know, a year and a half, they've taken this colt and broken him in a little bit. So, he could certainly be a valuable contributor moving forward.
Kanter, though, not as good of a matchup against the Warriors unless they're playing one of their backup centers.
Yeah, and that's the change that Donovan made throughout the series, is basically trying to match him up whenever Spates was out there. If I'm not mistaken, I think any time the Golden State death lineup was on the floor, there was no sign of Enes Kanter. Kind of got spooked because Golden State attacked him. I mean, starting at game one, and that's honestly what I expected to see in the San Antonio series. And we never really saw it, and it allowed Enes Kanter to stay on the floor. And, you know, he did a lot of work and was a big reason why they got by San Antonio. So I kind of thought he would come in useful, more useful than he did against Golden State, because he had some level of success against them in the regular season. But
yeah, he was very useful in the minutes that he was able to play. He just couldn't play that many minutes.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and again, he's got some work to do, but he has come a long way, I think, on the defensive end. I mean, we're talking from an F to a C minus.
Right.
But still, he has come that far. I don't know how much better he can actually get, because, I mean, I don't know if his feet are going to be able to move any faster, if his brain's going to be able to, you know, process things any faster. But I think they can do some things with him to be able to utilize him maybe a little bit more.
Well, I think, too, and part of the reason I'm going through all this sort of setting the scene is we're getting to the ultimate question of whether Kevin Durant wants to stay. And I think looking at really where this team is now, where they are going forward, I mean, let's say the Warriors bring back the same team next year. I mean, maybe Oklahoma City can bring in someone else. They'll get some more growth from the young guys. I mean, how are you feeling about their chances to beat Golden State or beat San Antonio if these teams match up again next year. I think all three of them are likely to be relatively similar.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, again, Oklahoma City could do what you said, bring back the same crew. The biggest source of improvement on this team is going to come from within. A lot of teams are going to have to go out and hit the free agent market, but Oklahoma City is built in such a way with all these young guys to where that's where the improvement is going to come from. And then if there's a piece they're missing, you know, it's going to be a budget piece they're going to go get on the free agent market, or they'll go make a small trade somewhere. It's possible they could make a larger deal, maybe involving Serge Ibaka, to shake something up. But the other thing that I would say as well, Sam Presti and company really value continuity. And the core four has been here, Durant, Westbrook, Collison, Ibaka, you know, since the franchise moved here. So Presti values that. So I don't think he's really anxious to shake that up unless something just flat out isn't working or someone just doesn't want to be here anymore.
Yeah, and Ibaka, another guy who great matchup against the Spurs, great matchup against the Warriors with his athleticism and length, his ability to shoot. I think for me, the biggest concerns for them is that while they did have a valiant effort in the series, they showed great connectivity. The switching was a great strategy. Some of the old bugaboos for this team were why they ended up losing, whether it was not moving the ball at all, especially down the stretch of games in game six, whether it was Russell Westbrook gambling way too much defensively, like when their defense broke down in game six, he was often at the heart of it. And, you know, so trying to be able to coach him up to not do that kind of stuff, whether it is not the role players just not being good enough shooters, Robertson, Waiters. I mean, the 3 out of 23 and the 7 out of 27 in those last two games, those are coming on open shots. And you got to have guys who can knock down those shots. Otherwise, they can just load up on KD and Russ too much. So those issues, I don't necessarily think are going away. I think that if Donovan can get them to play a more egalitarian style, that I do think Adams and Ibaka and Waiters can be guys that could play that way. I mean, I would love to see it if those guys actually get a touch, can initiate things and then move the ball. You know, the rare times they do that, it looks good. So maybe they can improve in that way. But I still would not say that I would not favor them as of now over the Warriors if they were to bring both teams back. And part of why I think they were able to do so well this time is because Steph was out of sorts for the first, you know, maybe 4.5 games of the series or so.
Yeah, and some of that, I think some of that was injury related. In other words, I think it had somewhat of an impact, meaning it probably.
Yeah, I mean, not taking anything away from that,
right,
too, because, like, I mean, it was, yeah, he was, if he was 80%, Oklahoma City is the team that makes the most out of that 20% that you're missing defensively.
Right. So I think there was that. And, you know, like any time Steph Curry got within the three-point line, he was just draped by seven-footers, it seemed like. So it made it uncomfortable for him. So Golden State did what they do best. They went out behind the three-point line, and unfortunately Oklahoma City didn't defend that nearly well enough, and that's what got him beat. So, yeah, you know, I'm looking at some of the pieces here and what they can do, and I think you hit it hit the nail on the head. Durant and Westbrook, you know, these are the two guys that are going to have the most bad habits that need to be cleaned up. I've seen it too many times from Russ in the entire time he's been here where, you know, someone makes a play on Russ. He comes down and tries to make a 9-point play. I mean, he tries to go for the kill when there's no kill to be had. There's a lot of those things that he just can't seem to help himself. He's got to rein that in. You know, Kevin Durant, costly turnovers, especially late in games, and their clutch stats. I don't have those in front of me right now, but if you look at their clutch stats, especially this season, they're kind of scary. So, and a lot of that falls on the two guys that the offense revolves around.
Yeah, and you don't want to overrate those, but on the other hand, watching it, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's a small sample, but also, like, there are process things that are leading to that result. And when you see that, you think, well, you know, I think that's something that can continue. And then you also have the fact that I think they just get tired late in games, too. You know, they're having to play 44 minutes. Steph and Clay were playing 40. And I think, you know, even that 4 minutes can kind of make a difference when you're just at the absolute highest level as this series was.
And I think one of the problems is the Thunder bench. And you know, rewind back I remember in the preseason, Denver came in and we were interviewing, you know, doing the huddle around Mike Malone, and he made a comment about the Thunder, said, oh, they're like Noah's Ark. They've got two of everything. And that was the expectation coming into the season, that this Thunder team was so deep they could go 10, 11, 12 if they needed to. And here we are, the last game of the playoffs, it was basically six guys, and Randy Floyd made a cameo appearance. So the bench faltered. Kyle Singler did not work out. He had occasional moments throughout the season, but overall it was just a bad year for him.
Yeah, well, the good news is that his salary in 2019-20 is unguaranteed.
Yes,
so
yes.
Only three more years of him for you guys to deal with.
That's right, yeah. I would always, you know, I would go on air and people would say, oh, we got four more years. Like, no, the last year's a team option. So always look on the bright side of life here, guys. So there was that. You know, Cameron Payne emerged as a backup point guard, and then after the trade for Randy Foy, fell out of the rotation. There was a lot of debate over, you know, should he continue to use him? But, you know, because he got used in the Spurs series and kind of had the deer in the headlights look. I don't know if it really would have mattered. I think Cameron Payne just needs time, but I think this guy's going to be really good, especially if he's able to, you know, kind of blend in and fit in with the team and not necessarily want more like other guards have wanted that have come through Oklahoma City. I think there's some potential there with him as well.
Yeah, I think I would feel good about him as my backup point guard to start the year next year. I mean, it would be Oklahoma City could probably make a harder push for home court advantage next year. I mean, this is getting way into the weeds,
yeah.
But you know, you have to imagine if the Warriors, regardless of whether they win or not, they are going to be exhausted. I don't see them like pushing so hard for the number one seed. You know, we've seen like when the Bulls tried to go for their three-peat, for example, they had much worse regular seasons the third year. So I think maybe the number one seed could be gettable for Oklahoma City next year, and that would be big. But that said, I mean, they aren't going to have a ton of resources to go get another point guard. Maybe they can try to get, you know, a vet third point guard caretaker type. But I think you start the year with Payne, and then if he's really just still not working out by the trade deadline, then maybe you can try and go find someone who's a little more of a stopgap. So let's get to KD now. Let's say you were just advising him on what to do, you know, try as neutral as we can be in this situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would you tell him to do? Assuming that his number one goal is to win games, win championships.
You know, the example I used last night on the post game, because there were some people legitimately upset with Kevin Durant after last night. And I think they were probably saying and tweeting a few things that they were probably deleting sometime early this morning. I said, I'm sure a lot of people in Dallas got frustrated with Dirk Nowitzki, but, you know, keep at it. It's real easy to pick up and go somewhere else and just expect it to be better. But there are other situations. And the other thing that I say, too, is that there's still plenty of time for things to unfold. So even right now, if we look at, say, Boston and say, well, you know, why would KD go there? Well, what if they shake up and make a major move or two and suddenly they are much more attractive and they've got a treasure trove of assets to keep the team going? You know, you'd have to look at that. Miami.
Yeah, they are. Oklahoma City is really lucky that there aren't any other big superstars that are going to change teams
right
this offseason, right? Like, because Boston, they could open up $50 million in space. The Lakers could do the same.
Yep.
If you could say, all right, KD, join another superstar in Boston with all the guys they already have, and they have all these draft picks too, like, then it would be like, all right, yeah, this would be awesome. And you're in the East too. But fortunately for Oklahoma City, there isn't really that go team up with another superstar. There's none of these teams that he could go to other than Golden State or the Spurs have a player the caliber of Russell Westbrook to play with, and probably not even the supporting guys the caliber of Ibaka and Adams.
Right. So really, I mean, Durant, his best option may very well be to, you know, give it another year in Oklahoma City and see what's out there in 2017, because there's going to be a lot more big name free agents available. There's going to be even more cap space. There's going to be time for some of these other teams like the Lakers, you know, to maybe show some sign of, you know, being an attractive destination between now and then. So, you know, all along, a lot of people have expected, you know, it's no big secret that he takes a short-term deal to reenter free agency for a variety of reasons. But I just think, give it another year here in Oklahoma City and, you know, with the cast that you've got, and then reevaluate things in 2017 where you'll have a lot better options available.
So can you explain to listeners why it makes so much financial sense for him to do that one-year deal with the second-year player option?
Yeah, so he falls into this weird situation thanks to the rising salary cap and the fact that he just completed 9 years in the league. At 9 years in the league, his first-year max salary, it falls in Tier 2, which is 30% of the salary cap, or actually a bit lower than that. I always use about 28% as my estimate. But at 10 years, he becomes eligible for the Tier 3 max salary, which would be, 35% roughly of the salary cap. So, and he has to sign a new deal in order to cash in and get that new max deal, since it doesn't auto-adjust if you sign a long-term deal. So because the cap is jumping up, because he's a nine-year guy and falling short of that 10th year, that's where, when you sit down and do the spreadsheets, in order for him to make the most money or have the option to make the most money, is to take a short-term deal and do this all over again in 2017.
Yeah, so if he were to sign the maximum he could, five-year deal, 7.5% annual raises this year, that would start at just under $26 million based on the $92 million projected cap. So that would be a five-year deal, $149 million.
Yep.
If he signs the one-year deal, he gets that $26 million this year, and then next year he gets to start at $35.2 million with the $107 projected cap. So you're getting $25 million this year, and then you can sign a five-year $202.8 million deal next year that would take you through 2021-22. Also, you're sort of, he would become, you're probably locking in for longer there too. I mean, if he's at 28 to get 5 years to take you through 32-33, maybe by that point he's not able to get that big of an annual value. You'd be making $45 million in the last year of that deal, which would be a pretty insane figure, but that's where the cap is going, and he, of course, would be worth that. It's the combination of having 10 plus years of experience and then also the cap going up an additional $15 million or so the next year.
And so, Kevin Durant is the rare guy that can afford to take that kind of a risk on a short-term deal.
Exactly.
Because even if he has some bad injury next season, there are going to be teams coming after him with max offers the following year, so he can take that risk.
Yeah, and as a tall guy, I think he's going to age pretty well. He's thin, not an injury risk other than just that one broken foot that looks like an aberration over the course of his career. And then the other aspect, too, which we haven't talked about, is that Ibaka and Westbrook can also be free agents next year. So you don't want to lock in for longer and then, oh, whoops, I'm taking up the whole cap and Westbrook and Ibaka are gone now. And so now I can't leave here. Now you've got a chance to see how next year goes. If it goes well, maybe they try and bring everyone back, although they'll have some tax concerns that we'll talk about with that. So it makes so much sense to me. Whereas, someone like Kevin Love or LaMarcus Aldridge last year, they didn't do the 1+1, even with the cap rising, because I think where they were in their careers, they want to just lock in for the longer term money. KD is just so good. I think even if he tore his ACL tomorrow and missed all of next year, he would still get a max.
Yeah, exactly. That's what a top five player in the league, that's the kind of luxury he gets. So, and that's what I always caution people. Last year we talked a whole lot about guys, like you just mentioned, taking short-term deals. They wound up all locking in long-term. There's always that possibility. Maybe there's some coordination between the front office and Durant to make this all work. But however, I still feel like, because Kevin Durant should go get every dime he can because he's that good, should keep, be as flexible as he's comfortable with.
Yeah, when you're a top five, top 10 player in the league, even if you're making the max, you are very underpaid.
Yes.
In terms of the contribution that you're providing for your team. All right, so what's it look like? Let's assume he does the 1+1, he stays. What's their offseason look like? How much space are they looking at that point when you consider that Waiters, he's going to be a restricted free agent. His cap hold will be about $12.7 million.
Yeah, so if KD returns, there's no cap room. If KD leaves, there's cap room. So needless to say, around here, we don't want cap room. We don't want it at all. If KD leaves and, you make some other decisions, you could open up, say $25 million, but that $25 million isn't going to buy what it used to, this coming summer.
Well, yeah, and you would have to dump Waiters.
Yeah, in addition to
capital to get that, too.
Yeah.
And, that because he's coming off his rookie contract, they can exceed the cap to re-sign him. So, I think the biggest issue for me that I see with them is whether they are going to be able to use the mid-level exception, because if you use that, you're hard capped at the apron. And if you just look at when you count waiter's cap hold, which I think, you know, might be close to what he ends up getting in restricted free agency, maybe he'll get a little bit more or a little bit less. We'll talk about that. But if you just assume he's going to make like 12 or 13 million, they are already within 2.7 million of the tax and 6.7 million of the apron. And when you throw in a contract for the mid-level exception at 5.6 million, you're now basically too close to the apron to use that, because when you use the MLE, you're hard capped. You would only have $1 million of maneuvering room. That's not enough over the course of the year. So if they just bring everyone back and waiters at around that number, they probably can't use the full MLE. They would have to be stuck with the mini mid-level exception, the taxpayer mid-level, which would be for $3.5 million next year.
And then if they decided to waive Anthony Morrow, that would open up a little bit more. I think kind of the wild card here, Nate, is Alex Abrines. This is their 2013 second-round draft pick. Was just named the EuroLeague Rising Star. That's usually a fairly good thing if you're named the EuroLeague Rising Star. I don't know for sure how he translates from EuroLeague to the NBA. I don't expect he's going to be that impact, you know, two-way two-guard that, you know, we've been dying for so long. But I think he could potentially come in and be part of the program and maybe fill Morrow's spot. The hang-up there is he signed through 2019. No one really knows what his buyout is. I've asked around, and I can't seem to get any information on it. I've been told that it's not that big of a deal. I don't know if that means it's $1 or $2 million, but that's a guy that I'm looking at who they would probably actually pursue with their mid-level exception, and maybe the mini mid-level would be enough to get him. Because I don't think he's making an extraordinary amount of money. But I would assume if they're going to use that and cash that in, it would probably be to try to bring him over.
Yeah, and the buyout is important because they can only pay $650,000, the excluded international player payment is what it's called, yep, kind of off the books. And then they basically, he's got to pay it out of his salary. So if he has a big buyout and they're only paying him $3 million a year, then it may not make financial sense for him to come over. I mean, is there any way you see they could open up more space? You mentioned Morrow. He's non-guaranteed,
yep,
at $3.5 million this year. He also has a guarantee date of July 15th, so that'll be plenty of time to decide to keep him around. I still think they could get more out of him than they do, but, you know, yet for whatever reason, he hasn't been trusted by two different coaches in his time there now. So, yeah, I mean, I think the mid-level might be enough for Abrines. I mean, I think of him as kind of – I haven't watched him a ton, but his reputation is kind of like a poor man's Manu Ginobili.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of thin, not a guy who maybe would work that well defensively with some of the switching that they're doing, but a guy who definitely could do a little something with the ball in his hands, hit a three-pointer, have some modicum of creativity, and certainly a player I think could help them over the course of the regular season.
Yeah, and so where I question about the dollar amounts is if you look at other guys in recent past, whether it's Bielitsa in Minnesota, whether it's Mirotić in Chicago, you know, those guys all got, I think, between $4 and $7 million in the first season to come over.
Yeah, Bielitsa was three, I want to say.
Yeah.
And those guys, it's a similar situation, right? Second round pick, so you've got the exclusive negotiating leverage, but there's also a buyout situation. I mean, I don't think Abrines has quite the level of reputation that Mirotić or Bielitsa had,
yep,
but so I don't know. If we don't know his buyout, it's hard to say, but I think he could maybe help them.
Now, as far as opening up, yeah, other space, I mean, I guess one potential is Nick Collison. I guess you could potentially, you know, waive him and stretch him out.
Yeah, they can't dump Mr. Thunder.
I know.
I mean, the whole
exactly
reason they gave him that ridiculous contract, I mean, making $3.7 million these last 2 years, which is a big-time overpay. And I remember, actually, I think someone years ago on Twitter, when he got that extension, someone like tweeted at Kevin Durant saying, oh, this is a ridiculous contract or something. Kevin Durant is like, no, like, that guy's Mr. Thunder. Like, screw you. Like,
right,
we're taking care of our own here. So, I mean, it's going to hurt them that they have him on the books for that instead of, you know, $1.5 million, what he probably should be making, since he doesn't play anymore and he's not really, you know, he can't really play against good teams. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine them dumping him at this point. I mean, maybe you could say they might trade away Huestis or McGarry, but those guys are so cheap, it's almost not really worth it anyway. But we are dealing with, you know, $2, $3 million here. It could be the difference between using the taxpayer MLE or the full MLE, also just what Waiters ends up getting. My prediction is they probably just end up using the regular MLE, the taxpayer MLE, and then they don't have to worry about this stuff as much.
Yeah, and then this is maybe a bit of a pie-in-the-sky scenario here, but let's go back to Kyle Singler. The one idea that I have is you're going to have teams across the league that are going to fall short of the salary floor. So they're going to have to spend that money regardless. Would they be willing to take a flyer? And I'm just going to pull a random team like Utah. And Jazz fans, don't come after me. I'm not trying to shove them off on you. But I'm just, as an example, if they're going to fall short of the floor, would they be willing to take him on, even though they're going to fall short of the floor for maybe a year or two, maybe rehab the asset, maybe they dump a, you know, similarly not so good contract on OKC, you know, to free up some money there. That's a potential.
Yeah, that's like a shorter one that they could stretch or maybe just move during the year. But I mean, the problem too, though, is that it's not like last year where they were over the tax and then they made the trade for Novak and they're able to get under the tax. Actually paying the tax, you can just get under by the end of the year and be fine because it's calculated as the end of the season. But if you use your full MLE, then you're hard capped for the whole year.
Right.
So that's kind of a difference there. And they would probably need to make such a move to open up the full MLE. But that's a good point. I mean, I wonder, what do you think it would take if you're another team? I mean, Singler is obviously a negative contract, but in this day and age, it's not that bad. There are teams that aren't using a ton of space. I mean, if they gave up a good second round pick, I don't know if they even necessarily have one, but would that be enough to take on Singler? I don't think they would want to use a first rounder to dump him.
Yeah, no, I would think you mean Oklahoma City having to include a pick?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's a negative. Right. My buddy Danny LaRue talks about is the Nene test of whether a guy is an asset or not in his contract. I think he clearly fails that.
Right.
But it's also pretty small, even though it is five more years.
Yeah.
Three more years.
Yeah, I could see. I mean, Oklahoma City has got they've got a couple of second round picks. One of them is a phantom second rounder from Boston, but I think more than anything, I mean, if they could just get a trade exception out of it and just have that flexible piece on hand in case a deal pops up later, I think they'd be fine with that, even if it costs them a decent second round pick to make that happen.
Yeah, Singler just completely falling off is so weird. I mean, like, why can't he hit a shot? Like, he just,
it is.
I mean, that's all he needs to do. But
yeah.
I thought it was a good trade for him. I thought he could help them. I thought that, like, that was a decent contract for him. They were buying low on him, but then he sunk even lower than when they were buying low on him somehow. Well, let's say they can open up enough space to use the full MLE next year. I don't think they would want to go that long because of the tax issues in 2017 that we'll talk about in a little bit. But, I mean, whether it's the mini mid-level or it's the MLE, are there any free agents out there you think realistically could become a rotation player and would come for that kind of price?
I've looked around, and the tough thing here is getting into the mind of Sam Presti, because he's got a certain type of guy. I mean, if it's a veteran, a short-term guy, you fall out of this range. But typically, he looks for guys that are in like the, you know, 24 to 28 age band, right around there. Now, occasionally there's a Randy Foy, there's a Steve Novak or something that comes along. But as far as like a long-term piece, those are typically the guys that he targets, and also specifically looking for guys that obviously he's going to have the bird rights to, hopefully restricted free agency, and have the advantage to retain them. So, but if you're looking at short-term deals, I mean, I glanced around at the free agent list a little bit, and I'm looking at perimeter guys for the most part, because I think you and I touched upon this. Oklahoma City really could have used another reliable shooter at some point in that Golden State series.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Morrow is that, but he can't stop anyone.
Yeah.
And at the level we're talking about, you know, back in the old days, because the MLE hasn't gone up the way the cap has, maybe you could have gotten a player like that with the full MLE. But now I don't think you're getting a two-way wing player. I mean, I'm thinking more of someone who can just maybe help out a little bit in the rotation. I'm not really sure, though, unless it's someone who's like, hey, I just want to ring chase a little bit, you know, that's really a vet. Maybe like a Matt Barnes type is someone. I don't know how well he would fit into their culture there, but
with he
you
and
know, he Serge might be
Ibaka,
the sort of
that's not happening.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot that they. I mean, we've seen some guys kiss and make
this
up in that respect before, but you know, I thought Stephen Adams actually had an interesting quote last night where he's like, you know, they're talking about Green and, you know, did he apologize? And like, no, you know, we're just competitors, and like,
yeah,
we hate each other between the lines, but like, no hard feelings outside. So I think guys can get over that kind of stuff more than you might think.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, anybody who's a brother who's like fought with your brother playing a pickup game in the backyard, like you kind of maybe understand that. But
right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking down the list here. There's nobody like Alan Anderson, maybe
that's
could be a guy
one.
That might be in that range.
He came to mind, and that's largely because of the injury riddled season that he just had. Maybe his market value is at a price that they could get because, you know, like you touched upon, you know, OKC's buying power is going to be minimized because every other team in the league is going to have buku of cap room. So I looked at Alan Anderson. I've looked at Jared Bayless. I've looked at Troy Daniels. That's a guy that's always kind of intrigued me. Eric Gordon, potentially, if Deion Waiters leaves. I'm a little on the fence on that. Dare I say Lance Thomas?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Eric Gordon would never. He's going to make 8 figures.
I would be
shocked if he doesn't make that much, in my opinion.
I was looking at buy low type guys that.
Yeah.
That maybe if the planets aligned, you could get like a James Posey type year out of them, where he.
Yeah, I mean maybe one option that they could look at would be, and again, this would be a sign and trade, so they'd be hard capped at the apron. But you know, if you could move Singler. And you could move, and maybe you got Waiters to resign for cheap. You maybe move some of the, you know, McGarry or Huesis as kind of considered maybe throw-ins that would help that. Maybe even throw in a first-round pick. Then maybe you might get into, you know, the sign-and-trade type of market for someone like Eric Gordon. But I think they like, I don't know if there's even anyone out there like that that's going to be a major part of the rotation. I mean, with the way Roberson played, the way they played defensively in these playoffs, you have to imagine they feel like Waiters and Roberson are, you know, a pretty decent combination there on the, at the two. And do they really want to give up that many assets to upgrade? And I say they could and maybe should, because then you can play small more often. And I thought that small lineup was really awesome mm-hmm. in the Golden State series. But and they could use another wing, so they're not playing everybody 8 million minutes in the playoffs.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, so that might be, you know, a sign and trade for, like, a Gerald Henderson type of guy, or, you know, maybe not Evan Turner because he can't shoot at all. Mm-hmm. Jared Dudley could be someone where maybe you, if you sign and trade, you can get a guy starting at, like, $8 million a year instead of $5 million. And now you're talking about someone like, you know, Aaron Aflalo, that level of guy. You're maybe a little bit higher in the market would be something they could consider.
Yeah, you mentioned Jared Dudley, the type of guy, I mean, dating back to when he was with Phoenix, I've kind of had my eye on him because I thought not only for what he brings on the basketball court, but I think he's a good guy and I think he would fit in, you know, pretty much anywhere because of the type of guy that he is. That would be really interesting as well. And, you know, to your point, thanks to the salary cap going up and the tax line and the apron, it opens up the possibility for Oklahoma City to do a sign and trade, because I think they could survive a year being hard capped if they created, like you say, just a little bit more flexibility underneath that, just in case they have to, you know, change things up during the season or go get an emergency backup third point guard or whatever the case may be.
What do you think Waiters gets, and what do you think, if you were Sam Presti, you would be willing to pay him?
You know, some of this comes back to KD, I think. If Durant is going to re-sign, even if it's short-term, this is not the time to, you know, start skimping out on your supporting cast, especially guys that have performed for you in the playoffs. So, you know, maybe you have to wind up matching whatever. If he gets an outrageous offer in free agency, maybe you have to match it. But I go back to the contract that he reportedly was offering Reggie Jackson. That was 4 years and $48 million. I think maybe that kind of fits under the new TV money coming in. That would be, you know, equivalent to, say, $8 or $9 million in today's money, which seems like still probably too much for a guy like Deion. But I keep coming back to that. Maybe something in the 4 year to $48 to $52 million range.
Yeah, we think about it for this year, an average starter probably going to make $15 million a year on the open market. And maybe next year that's 17 or 18 once you go up to 107. And, you know, I don't think of him as an average starter. He's coming off the bench.
Right.
I mean, I think if it were me, I would probably just try to see, because I think he actually helps the Thunder in a lot of ways more than he does other teams, because he's not good enough to really create on his own. I think playing as a role player, he has actually like really found something, whereas if he doesn't have other stars around him or you're putting him in a larger offensive role, he's just going to be really inefficient and also not able to lock in defensively as much. So I don't know. I mean, I think I would offer him the type of contract you're talking about. See if you can keep him out of restricted free agency. And if not, you know, I just let the market dictate it. And I mean, even worst case scenario, his qualifying offer is pretty high. I think it's $6.7 million. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he would necessarily take that, but as the number four pick, it's higher than for some. But once you get to the point where you're not offering him that much more as a starting salary, then maybe you might take that qualifying offer, and that wouldn't be the end of the world for Oklahoma City to just get everybody back and have the flexibility to either re-sign people or don't after you see how next year goes. And would you be worried about another team giving him a big free agent offer? I mean, the other downside is what happened with Enes Kanter. Portland had a crap ton of space. Mm-hmm. And I think some would argue just to mess with Oklahoma City, they gave him that big contract, which they had to match. There's going to be so many teams with space. Maybe the team will just do that to Waiters, knowing that, again, Oklahoma City has to match. And that could put them in big trouble.
Yeah, there's definitely some gamesmanship out there with Durant, Westbrook, Ibaka, and Adams all coming up for big paydays. You could see somebody try that. A lot of people keep coming back to Philadelphia, and I guess it's the whole going home theme. And who knows what Philadelphia is going to do under the new regime? I don't think.
Yeah, if they get Ben Simmons, I don't really particularly care for Waiters.
But no, I don't think so either. And you know, back to your point about, you know, carrying the team, I was so thankful when Billy Donovan finally started staggering Durant and Westbrook, because I could not handle watching those Waiters, Kanter led second units, because they hemorrhaged points throughout the season. So, yeah, if there is a team out there that says, I think this is our answer to the, you know, to our shooting guard woes, you know, like, I don't know, let's say Atlanta, because they're probably going to lose Kent Bazemore if they came after him.
Yeah, he's not an Atlanta. He's not an Atlanta type of guy. Like they're all like Spurs culture. Right. Like that would really shock me.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I don't necessarily see the team out there for him, but you know, if it's July 20th and you still have a crap ton of cap space to say, I mean, the situation Portland was in this year, there's going to be like six teams in that situation this year.
Yep.
Hey, might as well, you know, let's just mess up Oklahoma City for a little while. Do Deion's agent a solid. So that it's
all that gamesmanship.
It's definitely a concern. And I mean, I think also if they were to do 4 for $48 with the 7.5% annual raises, they could start him lower. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe start him around, you know, $10 million or so. I don't know the exact math off the top of my head, and that'll give you some more breathing room to potentially use the MLE or do that sign and trade as well. So yeah, maybe that'll happen. Maybe it'll be, you know, a 2-year deal. And they could even re-sign him to, you know, 2 years, $22 million, and give him a player option for next year. You know, that might be a direction he'd want to go in as well.
Yeah, the one thing that the Thunder have not been keen to do is include player options. They love certainty of things. And I honestly, I don't know this for certain, but I think last year they were trying to negotiate like a 4 or 5 year deal with Enes Kanter, like no options sort of thing. And trying to maybe at a lower price at $15.5 million per averaged. And, you know, Kanter wanted to re-enter free agency after the TV money hit. And that's when, you know, he found the team that could give him the contract that he really wanted. So, but yeah, historically, if there's any options in any of these deals, it's on the team side.
So let's talk about here. I mean, I don't think it's really worth talking about what happens if KD leaves, but maybe for a little bit. One option they could look at is, and they wouldn't have a ton of space to do this, maybe try to renegotiate and extend either Ibaka or Russ. I doubt either of them would do that. Maybe you could see Ibaka would. Like, the way that works is you use your cap space now, give them a raise, and then you can tack up to 3 years on top of that. I mean, do you think either of those guys would have any interest in doing that if Durant were to leave? That's the only way they would have the space to do it anyway.
Yeah, I've looked at it from Russ's standpoint. You know, in his case, you know, if that happened, I think $8 million would take him up to his new max salary. Is that enough for him to, you know, for an immediate $8 million bump, but you're only locked in for 3 more years and not, you know, 4 or 5 if you hit free agency? I don't know if that's enough for him. Again, it might be, if I'm Sam Presti and Kevin Durant leaves, I think that would be my first phone call, is trying to lock up Russell Westbrook long term. But that does come out of losing Deion Waiters as a result as well. I just don't know. If I'm Sam, I don't know if I want to go through that again next year, you know, where I have the possibility of losing my other franchise cornerstone and not getting anything back in return.
Yeah, but it's just financially, it's hard to necessarily see how that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, maybe you could say that getting $8 million more this year Then he signs on for one more year, and then at age 29, he hits the open market unrestricted again. And I think he actually probably would make money over the next 2 years by doing that. But with him being 27, the way he plays, I would actually, and then it'll be 28 when he's a free agent next year, I wouldn't want to go much past that. I would want to lock in that long contract for him. And I do think for him, the fifth year could be important with the way he plays. But let's talk about 2017 now. Let's say Durant comes back, and they are just to be facing a crazy luxury tax bill. They got Adams and Robertson, who will be restricted free agents then. I mean, let's just, what would be a number, just an estimate to pencil in for what those guys might get in a rookie extension this fall?
You know, Adams, I have thrown this around that if he gets to restricted free agency, is he going to get a max contract from someone? I think he could. And that's simply because, again, so much money going around, the laws of supply and demand. And I think we are maybe a little too ecstatic about Steven Adams. But still, I think he, if he hit restricted free agency, he could get a max or very near max type of contract. So,
yeah, I mean, he's a stop. Probably you would imagine he's going to be a top 10 starting center in the league.
Yeah. So
I think that's a realistic outcome for him.
Yeah. So, I mean, it would be to the Thunder's benefit to potentially get in there and, you know, try to lock it in and try to sell him on that possibility. But still.
Yeah, and his max that year, if he does get restricted free agency, for some context, would be a little over $25 million. So, you know, I was thinking maybe like if it's not going to be under $20 million a year.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah. I'm thinking somewhere in the 20 to 23 range. I mean, Stevens never struck me as the kind of guy that, you know, I'm going to go get every dollar that I can possibly get, you know. Maybe he would be willing to, in order to remain here, to stay a little flexible on that. But still, I think that's pretty much the ballpark we're talking about.
How about Robertson?
Robertson, I've kicked around $6 to $7 million, and I don't know if that's...
That sounds too cheap to me.
You think so?
Well, after the way he played in these playoffs, I mean, I think just you're generally... And again, they're in this situation where... I mean, they're probably going to have to get rid of one of these guys, as we'll get to, but where they're trying to retain their own, they're contending. I mean, I when you consider... He starts,
yeah.
You know, he's and there's hope that he could get better at shooting. He is a game changer defensively. Also, his ability to play the four in small ball lineups that we finally saw in these playoffs against the Warriors is something that I think could really help his value quite a bit. You know, if he, you know, to play and pick and roll as the screener, get on the offensive glass, that type of stuff. I could see 12 for him. I mean, when you consider an average starter would make 18, and he does start,
yeah.
You know, so.
Possibly, yeah. And how I was coming about that number is I was basically kind of looking at Tabo Sefolosha's salary. And then factoring in the you know, cap bump, and then factoring in the, you know, that he's much younger than Tabo was during his time here in Oklahoma City, and so that's where I arrived at that range. But that is an interesting thing to think about, you know, going forward, because that to me that sounds reasonable right now. But you're right, maybe give him another year and give him a summer, and we might have a totally different opinion on him. And yeah, that number could go up.
Yeah. Although on the other hand, after the series that he had against the Warriors and how good they looked at times, like this could be the apex of his values, who we don't know. So,
true.
But all right. So, I mean, let's say combined between those two guys, you're at maybe, you know, a minimum of $30 million. And then now you're going to re-sign Durant. This is the best case scenario too for them, right? You re-sign Durant, as we talked about, he's going to start at $35 million. You re-sign Russ, he'll be in the lower experience level. That's $30 million. Now you got to re-sign Ibaka too. What does he think he's going to get?
He's going to be over 20, right?
Yeah, he's got to be.
I would think so.
Yeah, I mean, he's unless he just falls off a cliff next year.
Or something comes out and he's actually 4 years older than anyone really thought. I mean, I think it would take something like that for his value to go down, because this is probably going to be the last big contract that he gets. So I'm thinking, yeah, something in the, again, 20 to 23 million range.
No, that seems about right to me too. I mean, he's nominally 27, and I think his shooting is underutilized. Another team, especially if another team wanted to just say, hey, we're just going to make you our stretch five to start,
yeah,
and we're going to play pick and pop with you all the time. Like, he could actually be a better offensive player than, you know, I think he has shown in Oklahoma City. Yeah, so you got that. You put all those together, still paying Enes Kanter $17 million.
Yeah.
Maybe he would be the guy that you try to move at that point. You know, you've got some of the rookies on there too. So just I gamed it out. I would have them, the cap would be 107, the tax would be 127. I would have them at a team salary of almost $150 million, $22 million over the tax, and then another $54 million in luxury tax payments, Clay Bennett will not be paying that.
I don't think so. Now, having said that, I do think this team, you know, contrary to popular opinion, they have been willing to spend. They were just kind of waiting for the right time. And that time
is
now.
That's an astronomical amount. That's your that's $200 million in team salary and tax, which in a relatively small market. And maybe they would just have to do that. But if they were to dump Cantor, that basically then puts you right back at, you know, pretty close to the tax line, and your bill is manageable.
And this is where Oklahoma City's talent pipeline is so crucial. You know, guys like Mitch McGarry, second round pick from last year, Dakari Johnson, you know, having these guys in the pipeline, and they don't have a draft pick this year. I imagine by the end of the draft, by the end of the night, they're going to have bought a draft pick off somebody in order to collect some an asset or two and kind of, you know, keep replenishing that supply, because you're right. At some point, there will come a breaking point where they're going to have to make a difficult decision in there. And hopefully they've got, you know, someone in the pipeline that can step up and absorb that role.
Yeah, but also with all those guys being free agents, that's just so much variability if next year doesn't go that well. I mean, they could lose Durant, Westbrook, and Ibaka.
Yeah.
You know, that's like it would be – I mean, that's the other thing. You know, that's why you worry about these bridges when you come to it, because this team could look a lot different in 2017. I think that's not what Thunder fans would want, but I think that is quite possible. And then, you know, and even if they lose one of those guys, you're going to have no way to replace them really with you know, everybody's big cap holds and stuff like that.
It's frightening possibility, and yeah, it's a very legitimate possibility. And so the, you know, what I hope for is, you know, I look at San Antonio and kind of the relationship that the front office and the players have formed there, you know, over time. Duncan, Parker, Ginobili was just kind of like, yeah, go get what you can and let me know what you got left over and I'll take it. You have to hope that maybe the Thunder front office is forging those similar type of relationships with the players, you know, so they can kind of give and take a little bit. And still, I think something's going to have to give at some point. I think, like you just rattled off, you know, what, six or seven guys making double-digit salaries, you know, or I should say eight-figure salaries. Something would have to give regardless at some point.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, this was great. Thank you so much for coming on. Let everyone know where we can follow your work.
Yeah, thanks so much. So my Twitter handle is at John M. Hamm, and that's JonMHamm. So, yeah, follow me on Twitter. I contribute to DailyThunder.com. I do.
I can assure you, by the way, ladies, that he is just as handsome as the Mad Men actor in person.
I would say even more handsome. That's just my take.
Don't worry. Don't let this color your opinion of his basketball analysis. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and all the time, you know, people come up to the actor asking him salary cap questions, and like, I don't know. I contribute to Daily Thunder. Royce is kind enough to let me put my crap up there from time to time. I'm on the radio here locally, 107.7 The Franchise. I'm on throughout the week and on the weekends, and I, whatever opportunities come my way. I mean, I've even been on New Zealand radio recently. So basically, if you ask me to come on air, there's a good chance I'll say yes.
All right, man. Well, hopefully we will get a redux for this awesome series next year, and I'll get to see you in Oklahoma City. Again, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Thanks so much to everyone who's giving us a rating on iTunes or a review. And we actually were up to number 10 in the professional sports category over the weekend. So we really appreciate all the support. Tell your friends about us, too. It's been a great ride for us, and we really appreciate being able to bring this coverage to people during the playoffs. So for John Hamm, we will talk to y'all next time.
Thanks again to Athletes Collective for sponsoring today's episode. They offer great quality, great fitting activewear without the logos for 30 to 40% cheaper than the big brands by going to athletescollective.com. So you can go there, enter the promo code CAPSPACE, and get 15% off your first order. Promo code CAPSPACE to let them know that you came from us. All orders, of course, include free shipping and return to the U.S. or Canada. 100% satisfaction guaranteed at athletescollective.com. Promo code CAPSPACE.